I usually tape on the Podium Game podcast here. We've been doing previews for each series. But, oh yeah, and I'm Brian Gibberman. I was a moron, and I left my laptop at home instead of bringing it into work two straight days, and we weren't able to tape. So I'm finally joined by Jacob Rosen, waiting for next year, Andy Liu, Golden State of Mind. And instead of the preview, we are doing it between Games 1 and Games 2. And you know what? We're kind of lucky because the series is kind of completely different.
Are we lucky, Brian?
Oh, we are lucky in terms of we didn't waste the half hour taping about something that lasted one game and then was completely useless. We are very unlucky in terms of what our eyes are going to witness over the next three games.
No comment on that, but I would say that, you know, my father's been unlucky, my uncles have been unlucky, you know. It's been a long lifetime, man.
I've found myself saying now every single series that I really wish this person had played, I really wish this person has played. And so this is the fourth series counting. Now that we've done Drew Holiday, or for me, I've done Drew Holiday, I've done Mike Conley, I've done Patrick Beverley, and now Kyrie Irving. It's almost like it's a theme. At this point, I don't know what to feel in times like these. I'm not really sure what anybody should feel, but certainly it's a bittersweet, really less sweet, honestly, if you're looking at it from kind of a just basketball perspective. I don't know. I really don't know what to say beyond that. It's depressing, and at the same time, any human, any fan, or, you know, person would feel, look, this is what we're dealing with, and it's bad for everyone involved besides the team you're rooting for. And that's just a really weird feeling that I can't really put into words. That's why I'm kind of blabbering at this point.
Well, the Cavs fans experienced it a little bit last round, too, you know? Like, nobody expected Kyle Korver and DeMar Carroll when he missed some time and things like that to happen last series. So, and then, you know, obviously Shelvin Mack at the very end. That was like a weird series where you're cheering for things to, you know, for the Cavs to win, and then like, oh my God, everyone's getting hurt around you.
What's kind of depressing is how good he looked. It was like, oh, Kyrie's back, and then it just out of nowhere he like stopped right on a dime, and he just
which you know, I'm sure I will say a few things, and it will lead to a little bit of a conversation with Andy, but. Which makes me say that it wasn't something related to the injuries from the past. I'm not a doctor. I don't think I'd play a Twitter doctor too often. But a fractured kneecap, to me, doesn't scream like something that is necessarily preventable. Or you could have, you know, maybe the tendonitis led to it. I don't think so. I think it's just something that happened, and it's unfortunate, and it sucks. And that's the revisionist things you get back to, like, you know, what if he continued to play like that, or what if he doesn't get hurt, or what if he doesn't go to overtime, or anything like that, and it's just tough.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm not a Twitter doctor, but with the way he looked, I mean, you can't, I would insinuate that he, I don't know about completely healed, but he looked as healthy as I'd seen him the entire playoffs.
I agree with that. He looked great. I mean, he was playing. He blocked Steph. He blocked a game-winning layup. I had the angle on that. I mean, I wasn't sitting too close, but it was the perfect angle for me watching Steph go by him, and I could see Steph's back. And then I thought it was a layup. I thought Steph would probably maybe even go reverse, because sometimes he just goes reverse for no reason, just because he does weird. He kind of does like really stuff that's flashy, and he just kind of does that for no reason. And in this case, probably he should have done it, but who? I mean, if it was Anthony Davis behind him, or I guess Tristan Thompson behind him, he probably would have went reverse. But I mean, regardless, he did it, and then Kyrie kind of caught up to him, you know, at full speed, and kind of did a LeBron. And it wasn't a LeBron chase down block, but it was a chase down block. And I almost screamed, like, "What? What just happened?" I mean, if there's any proof of him kind of, I would say even sandbagging the injury before, kind of, you know, how the Cavs said, you know, this guy, there's no way he's 100%. And it tricked me. I thought there was no way he'd be 100%. And that's why I thought the Warriors would crush them. And then he goes ahead and you know, plays great defense on Steph and gets that block at the end. And I'm just like, there's no way that that knee is bothering to a point, unless he took, like, you know, 5 cortisone shots and can't feel a damn thing in his knee. But yeah, but to your point about playing him when he's injured, I think my point was that what the Warriors were doing, in terms of rest and keeping healthy was what I was insinuating. I can't speak to other teams because I'm not as versed on that matter, unless it's the Chicago Bulls, and then of course I have a lot of whining to do, as does everyone else. But just in terms of the Warriors, I feel like it was a perfect season in terms of their training staff, getting them healthy, and how they've evaluated players from that aspect.
Well, yeah, nice.
The Hawks, to a certain extent, had a similar thing, too. Yeah. Injuries are such just a fickle thing in any sport. It's tough. You can't predict it. You know, the Spurs have been the Spurs, but even the Spurs have had years where they've been banged up or couldn't perform well in the playoffs or just lost an unlucky game. So whether it's injuries or anything, I don't know if, you know, the rest thing is necessarily just, you know, a great strategy. You know, things happen, whether they were a product of great operations and great processes or just kind of what happened in the end as a result of something, I don't know.
Having a plus 10 point differential also makes it nice and easy to not play your players
yeah.
much.
Exactly. And then, I think that was the thing that went hand in hand. It's not that the Warriors are they didn't go out of their way to rest people. You know, Steph played 33 minutes a game this season, which is ridiculous considering Mark Jackson pretty much played him until he died the past two seasons. He would play 45 minute games, and Steph would be like, hey, you know, this is how it's going to be. He didn't mind it, mainly because, as from the coaching standpoint, he really didn't know better. And now he does. It's not as if the Warriors forced him to sit out those 15 minutes in every game. It's because they were up by so much. So from that standpoint, it's really both things, how good the Warriors have been, and that in turn has led to them being able to rest players, because if you're not winning games by that 10-point differential, you're not just going to rest guys for, you know, entire fourth quarters. So they definitely go hand in hand. It's not a mandate that the training staff has put out there for that team.
Jacob, we'll leave it up to you. Do you still want to depressingly talk about Kyrie, or should we move it along?
We can move it along.
Okay. So let's still look back at the last game. Let's go to the Mozgov play. Travel, no travel.
It's probably a travel by the books. It just rarely kind of gets called in the NBA, and I was surprised to see it called in that instance. You know, Mozgov has a knack for having some pretty advanced moves, considering how awkward he normally looks on the court. He is a pretty good shooter, as evidenced by him shooting like 80-something% free throw line in the playoffs. He made a few outside shots in the game. He's made a few during the course of the run. And he's got some advanced moves in the post, and that was just one of his moves where he jumps and moves around and frustratingly still puts the ball on the ground. And that was just one of them where he somehow managed to spin around everyone. And yeah, that was frustrating. But yeah, I think by the book, it's technically a travel, sure.
I haven't really rewatched the game yet. I'm going to right after this. But I guess it didn't look like it from, it seemed like any other move. From my standpoint there, from my view, though bringing it to a broad aspect, it was interesting to see Mozgov dominate Bogut after really he always plays really well against Bogut, and I don't know why, honestly. I don't really have a reason beyond in this game. I would say that because of the way LeBron was playing. And kind of having – he forces the other Warriors to play a half-double, which in turn doesn't allow Bogut to really have a hand on him, which is what he loves to do against everyone. You can ask Dwight Howard, who hates it. But mainly because of that, Mozgov and Tristan Thompson really gets running head starts toward the rim and is a main reason why they dominated the boards and really got open. And Mozgov, I think, dunked over Draymond, over Bogut twice. Yeah, those are some fierce dunks. So that was interesting to watch, and probably something the Cavs will have to keep doing going forward.
Yeah, it's interesting to, like, the whole offensive rebounding thing's crazy with both those guys on the court. I don't know if it's, like, a design. Like, it's funny how Tristan grabs those boards from the most ridiculous places on the court. Like, he's jumping around the free throw line, and, you know, Tristan, who plays like he's 6'5", because he plays with this gigantic butt, and he just, like, jumps and just, like, you know, falls down and, like, looks around. And he plays like he's so little, but then he jumps and leaps and grabs the ball near the free throw line or the three-point line or the corner, and it's just, like, the weirdest angles, and I think they've kind of gotten a rhythm to it a little bit. And Mozgov and Tristan did what they've done all playoffs, which is just be at the right places at the right time all over the court in the weirdest angles to keep getting those crazy rebounds.
And I'm in the process of looking this up as we talk. They probably need to play together a little bit more than they did in this last game, would be my guess.
Yeah, that was interesting, yeah.
They have it per game. Give me the totals.
You know, they didn't play much, and Mozgov hasn't played much in fourth quarters all season, let alone the playoffs.
Let's
see. But yeah, when you take a short 8-man rotation down to a 7-man rotation again, where your two bench players are J.R. Smith and James Jones, yeah, in the end.
So they played, it was 27 minutes. In those 27 minutes,
they grabbed like 35% of the offensive rebounds.
I'll have that for you in a second. Right, and they were a +6 net rating, and they grabbed 36% of the offensive rebounds, correct. So, I mean, you probably
30-ish all playoffs.
Yeah, they got, and you'd say they have to play 32 to 33 minutes together right now, right?
Essentially, all the Cavs have to play 45 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. And
No,
go ahead, Andy.
Essentially, I think that was the thing that really hurt the Warriors in the beginning, and it kind of forced Steve Kerr to, I guess, weirdly enough, just stick to that big lineup, just because he was so scared of the bigs in that moment. And it took him until essentially 2 minutes, no, 3 minutes left in OT to put Draymond Green at the five. And I think part of his thinking was that by that time, Mozgov was so tired, and really Tristan didn't really play the latter end of crunch time, and they pretty much blew him off the floor at that point. So I expect to see that small lineup that occurred throughout there, regardless of whether Tristan and Mozgov are playing, and that will be an interesting matchup. Him kind of hoping the Cavs wear down, which is really what Kerr was hoping for LeBron the whole time last night.
Yeah.
Sticking, I thought it was weird. I thought Blatt should have went to Shump over J.R. Smith. I don't know what point that thought went into my mind, but there came a point I was like, all right, this is, and it was one of those J.R. nights where, and he's been great for a very extended, pretty much the entire playoffs to this point, but it was one of those nights where J.R. very clearly did not have it going after he had a couple shots early. He got into a real funk, and he was missing some ugly shots. He had a shot block that he forced. It just wasn't his night. He wasn't in sync, and I thought he stayed with him too long. I said this on Twitter last night. It was very Mike Woodson-ish.
You know, the Cavs don't have very many options to a certain extent, too, and with the way that the offense was sputtering, you would have hoped there'd be a little more ball movement happening. And I think that would be the case for either team. To a certain extent, neither team was as aggressive in terms of ball movement and pick and rolls as they normally are. You know, I know the Warriors are known for not necessarily just pick and roll, but you see a lot of things happening. And I didn't see that as much as I had in the regular season. And the Cavs certainly, you know, half of their possessions were dribbling until about 10 seconds left, passing it to the wrong post, and then watching him go. And you normally would at least have a few more things going on, where JR would be in maybe a little more rhythm along, you know, those threes that he'd like to get in rhythm to a certain extent, or contested, but in a little more comfort. You know, that's the whole thing about JR is he usually likes his contested shots, but none of them seem to be in a normal rhythm of things at all, besides, you know, perhaps the one shot at the end of the second quarter where that hid a terrible second quarter from him as well. But just overall, both teams seemed out of sync in terms of what they usually do offensively.
Defensively, Golden State, Andy, Golden State pretty much Now, maybe it wasn't executed in the same way, but they pretty much just took their game plan from the Houston series and what they did with Harden and transferred it to LeBron. Now, I'm assuming with these they're different players, they probably had to do it in a little bit of a different way, but the end point of what they wanted was pretty much the same, right?
Yeah, I mean, that essentially, just a high-level aspect of it was the same. They wanted if LeBron was going to beat him, he would beat him. And now the way they defended him was a little bit different. I think they fought over for Harden a lot more, which really left the pick and rolls, but the high pick and rolls with Dwight Howard kind of left that open a lot, mainly because they had to go over and they couldn't really stay under and give Harden that 3-point shot. Now against LeBron James, they sat all day. They really took two steps back at times and let LeBron shoot those threes. And really, those mid-range jumpers as well, where he could just step in and do it. And LeBron would take him, but you do see him hesitate once in a while if he's from three. So that's one thing that did work. But it was interesting, I think, from an aesthetic standpoint and from an environmental standpoint. LeBron really controlled that game for a good, I'd say, maybe all the way up until the fourth quarter. It controlled that crowd, too. The crowd was standing, and it was really loud at certain points, especially when, you know, the Warriors string together maybe two or three buckets at a time. And I thought Cleveland defense did really well, actually, stemming runs, mainly because LeBron would come down on the floor after a couple buckets and kind of just tell everyone to calm down with his hands, and kinda, which essentially just meant get the hell out of the way. Let me post up Harrison Barnes, let me post up Draymond Green, let me post up Klay Thompson, or whoever it was, and he would just go in and shoot like a little floater, make it, and then it, essentially at a certain point in the fourth quarter, crowd was just dead, like dead silent and just scared, and kind of I compared it to, it was just like a stress disorder at that point. I think that's what happens, and I was in awe. I think that's what happens when you play against one of the greatest players of all time, and he could just take away what I think is the best home court advantage in the league, and he did. He took it away for a good, you know, the entire game, really, until he ran out of gas there at the end.
And do we think, he wore down at the end, and then just once in that overtime, I mean, they shot 1 for 9. The one bucket was essentially meaningless. They really didn't score a real point. Michigan did that multiple times in college basketball this year. I think they went scoreless in overtime twice, so I know how you're feeling, Jacob. Just nothing left in the tank at that point, or was it the Warriors' defense?
I'm sure Andy and I will disagree a little bit on this one, but I think there was a little bit more hesitation built in. Perhaps it was fatigue. I don't think we, you know, I saw LeBron as fatigued as perhaps he was at different points of the Chicago series or whatnot. But I think there just was a lack of, you know, energy. The Kyrie injury really sucked a lot out of the team overall-wise. Like, you know, that seemed to, when he limped off, when he couldn't come back on the defensive end, that really seemed to be the end. You know, they seemed to lose hope. I don't know if that was fatigue. I don't know if that was LeBron not being creative enough offensively, which you could have accused him of for most of the game, taking bad shots, not passing the ball, just pretty much dominating the ball for the last 10 to 15 seconds of possession. And he did a lot of those same things in the fourth quarter and overtime when it mattered more, and it didn't work out. You know, would you call a lot of the plays he made toward the down the stretch in the fourth quarter fatigue? I don't know. I think it was overall just some bad decision making and a lot of, you know, overall sense of, you know, defeat when Kyrie went down.
Yeah, and I think it pretty much alludes back to the point where Kerr kept his small lineup until they could, you know, pretty much go all out at the end, and Mozgov had his hands on his knees, and you know, it's tough for a guy to play that many minutes when you're that big. You certainly see Andrew Bogut struggling, and he's really only playing 20, 25, 28 minutes a game. And I can only imagine how it feels to be Mozgov at that point. I think somebody in the media room asked LeBron, "Were you tired at the end?" And LeBron kind of gave him a look.
Yeah,
and he gave him a look like, "What?" And then the guy said, were your teammates tired? And then kind of shifted the question, which was pretty funny. And then LeBron answered by saying, we're all pretty, you know, but we've got to fight through it. You know, a cliche response, but I thought that was interesting, just to the point. Really has nothing to do with anything, but just to the point where guys are scared of asking LeBron a question about whether he's tired. So he certainly won't answer that. I never see him tired. The only time I think I've ever seen him tired is that what was that Pistons game where he almost collapsed after he scored 80 points in a row there, which was really one of the greatest games I've ever seen.
And cramps get him, you know. That's right. The thing about LeBron is when cramps hit him, which is what did earlier in the playoffs. It's what did last year against San Antonio. When the cramps get him, you can see it. And when he's slower, you can kind of see it. Or when he chooses to not come back on a defensive possession, you can see it. I don't think I saw that, per se, in the fourth quarter and overtime for him, but I just saw a lack of creativity on the offensive end. And, yeah, and then when, you know, Golden State would go on runs, they obviously came on a run to bring it back from a 10- to 15-point deficit early on. And when they go on runs, they go on runs, and they're destructive, and that's how they've been so dominant all year. And the Cavs really had no energy by that point. And that's, you know, that's the whole – the usual thing is that when you're a road team and you go to overtime, it's really difficult to come back from two straight buckets from the home team because of just the energy and the crowd and the momentum. And combine that with Kyrie's injury, and it was just a lost cause by that point.
So how do they go about matching up at this point without Kyrie? Do you deli on Curry, or do they cross match still?
I don't think the matchups were necessarily any easier with Kyrie. You know, I was shocked to see Kyrie start the game on Steph Curry for the first, like, 4 or 5 minutes.
But he did decently.
Yeah, he did decently, and things worked out relatively well, even with J.R. playing on guys like that at times. But I was nervous as hell almost the entire game for any time that Steph or Klay got the ball. And it seemed that, you know, they just didn't get into a rhythm. Perhaps that was some, you know, great job by the Cavs, but it just didn't seem like the Warriors were playing their best offensive game either, which is obviously the nervous part of, you know, how things might go forward from here. But I think in the end, the Cavs sans Kyrie, sans Love, with a 7-man rotation essentially, and maybe we'll get 2 minutes of Kendrick Perkins, which would suck.
Here for Perk NBA Finals minutes.
But the whole thing is that they want it to be ugly. They want it to be scrappy. They want there to be offensive rebounds. They want the game to be in the low 90s, which is what it was tracking for a lot of the game yesterday. If that's the case and they're winning the offensive rebounds and Steph and Klay aren't going off, then they'll have a shot. Like, there's a lot of ifs into that statement. There clearly is. There was a lot of ifs that happened in any NBA game too. But the Cavs played incredible basketball against a eventually banged up Chicago and Atlanta team by being scrappy and winning offensive rebounds and playing really, really surprisingly good defense. And maybe that was what we saw last night. Maybe it was just hesitation and not great offensive play from Golden State. But if that's the case, you know, this could turn into an ugly affair that maybe will go 5 or 6 or something. That's kind of where I am.
Or 4.
It's good. I think the series could still be scrappy and tough from here on, because the Cavs have played that way for the last couple rounds, even sans Kyrie for a lot of it.
Yeah, I tend to agree with most of that. I was really surprised by the Cavs' defense there. Probably my fault for not watching enough East games.
No, but that's not your fault.
But then again, I mean, it was an overhaul at this point. I watched a lot of Cavs in the regular season. I kind of didn't in the postseason, mainly because I have time and honestly because I didn't want to. The East was pretty unwatchable at that point. But yeah, I pretty much called it. They wanted it to be Eastern Conference basketball, which is really what Jacob just said. They wanted to get it ugly. They had a sequence where they got 3 offensive rebounds but didn't score a basket. Which was, I was just like, man, what am I watching? But that was exactly what they wanted to do. It was, I think Golden State was getting out-hustled. Not out-hustled, but they were getting out-fought to the ball. Golden State was definitely fighting for it. They just weren't getting it. And that was because the help defense and guys being just big and strong. You know, Tristan Thompson. Really, I was wrong on that, and I got to admit it. When you're wrong, when Tristan Thompson is at certain points too big and too strong for Draymond Green, and he dominated really from opening tip. He didn't score much, but he got at least tracking it. I think at least 4 or 5 extra possessions. But it's just that Cleveland didn't score on those possessions, also, which in turn kind of skews that aspect when you see so many offensive rebounds and the Cavs still losing. It's essentially that they still couldn't score even they got the offensive rebounds, and that's a testament to maybe Golden State kind of knowing maybe that Cleveland the conceding at that point where hey, we know they're going to get rebounds because we're going to be out of position because we're scared shitless of LeBron, and then. They know that's going to happen. Maybe they knew that when they get rebounds that they would pass it back out to J.R. Smith and Shumpert, and we've got to close out on that and funnel them to the hoop again. And again, when they're funneled to the hoop, they'll shoot and they'll miss, and we're going to have to fight for rebounds again. So it seemed like Golden State was ready in that aspect, though it was still hard to watch them get dominated, I think, throughout the first half, pretty heavily on the boards.
I think with Tristan Thompson, I think we're at the point where, look, he's getting credit and attention, but I think it's too specified in a way. I think he's only – people are just acknowledging the offensive rebounds. I think he's become a legitimately really, really good player also because of what he's doing on the defensive end. Yeah, like he's doing some decent stuff in the switches and his foot speed. Like he's a good all-around basketball player. It's not just the offensive rebounds.
And I think I think most long forwards, and I don't mean this to say anything about Tristan Thompson. Terrence Jones really did this well as well, and he's not a similar player, but lengthwise and foot speed, really really similar. Most big forwards really do stay with Steph well, regardless of Steph's ball handling and whatnot, because Steph's not the type of player to really get into the lane like a Kyrie Irving. Doesn't do that, so Steph kind of dances around the perimeter and tries to get, you know, an inch of space to unleash that jumper. And to the naked eye, really, it seemed like Terrence Jones and maybe even Tristan Thompson plays good defense, and they did. They really did. They stayed up to him, didn't let him go by, kind of, you know, didn't trip over their ankles, especially when you're trying to guard Steph out there. But it's just that when it's Steph Curry, when he has that extra foot of space, that's really all he needs to get that jumper going. And that's why it seems, hey, look, it's a huge mismatch at this point. And at times it is, but there's really nothing someone like Tristan Thompson and Terrence Jones can do because they really are playing good defense and they're contesting that shot. And I think it's a little similar to what J.R. Smith does, because when J.R. Smith shoots, he's like falling backwards for some reason. And really, that shot's unguardable, and it seems like a bad shot, but it's not because it can't be blocked, and that's the way he shoots it. And that's him in rhythm. And when somebody's in rhythm, you can't really argue whether it's a good shot or not, mainly because they feel good about it. And really, that's all that matters when you're trying to get someone a shot.
I thought out of everyone that I've watched switch on to Curry this postseason, and he didn't play a ton of minutes, I thought outside of maybe Anthony Davis in the first round, Clint Capella has done the best job on him.
That length, yeah. I think that's the thing that gives Steph the most trouble. And I think a lot of people have asked me pretty much what's Steph's weakness, if he even has a weakness. It's length for someone as small as he is. He's not the great. He's a good finisher, but he's still not great. So you want him to drive, but Steph knows that, and he really doesn't really look to drive. If he's looking to drive, he's still looking to pass, and that's why he really doesn't shoot any free throws. He loves that jumper. Of course, as he should. And Clint Capella is the type of long, super long player that gave him trouble. Anthony Davis really forced him into several air balls, and really had him pretty shook until game four, where Steph was hitting, you know, absurd falling down jumpers. Where what can you even do? There's no point. At that point, there's really nothing you can do. But I think Anthony Davis, that was when Anthony Davis was really a guy that dominated defensively just because he could switch on to Steph and block guys at them. I was so amazed at that point.
Steph's just insane. The shots he makes, you know, there are a couple of times where Tristan was a second slow and boom, bang, a against Mike Santa broadcast. And it's just insane. He looks like he's goofing off. You mentioned this earlier. He goes for the crazy off-balance nonsense dribble or play or shot for no good reason half the time. Just to make it fun. He looks like he's literally just toying with everyone. And sometimes that's great, and it's just insane what he can do. There's no way to guard him.
I said the most fun thing about this was you had two guys in the NBA, and it sucks now we don't have Kyrie anymore, but we had two guys in the NBA Finals at this stage, and like there's times when it's like you're watching an N1 mixtape. It's like, holy shit, this is happening in the NBA Finals, what these guys are doing on a basketball court like that. It was so much fun.
Yeah, that level of shot making there, I think, in that second half, really. And I really can't wait to watch it again. Just when they were pretty much throwing hit, you know, just going back and forth was ridiculous at that point. And I think I was sitting in a section with guys that were a lot more credentialed than I am. They had no reaction. It was guys like Lowe and Amick and all those guys. I was really observing them to see how they would react. And they had no reaction to that. And to me, I was just sitting there like, you know, not even specifically for the Warriors. It was when LeBron James made shots or Kyrie Irving finishing and Mozgov and everything that happened there in the second half. And I was just sitting there like just amazed at that level of shot making. I asked, I don't remember who it was. I asked, you know, have you ever seen this level, you know, the way LeBron has done this level of just how he's taken over this entire game and arena in the NBA Finals. And they're really that question, I don't even know how to answer that. He played a lot like growing up, how I watched Kobe play. Just the way he would shoot so much, but it would be so fun to watch, even if it's inefficient. And that's how I feel what he's done, especially when he has that jumper going. It's great. It's great to watch.
It was a great game. It really was. It was a lot of fun for 48 minutes. What I've been, like, my recent thing has just been, like, you know, if the Cavs were to steal one in Oracle, it would have just, like, you know, people would be talking about, you know, how great is LeBron? Oh, my God, the Cavs won. This is going to be a series. And then just like that.
It's two straight series. Now, three straight games in the – with not counting – for in games one and game two, in the last two series, that the Warriors were there to be had, and the Rockets didn't take advantage of it, and now in this game, the Cavs didn't take advantage of it. Now the Cavs will have another shot. You think that and that Rockets series would have been so much different if they would have been able to pull out one of those first two games. It's going to be interesting to see if the Cavs can actually, even without Kyrie, if LeBron can kind of just bring them back in, maybe get Shumpert and JR some better looks from find ways to get them some clean looks from threes. Tristan Thompson scores more than 2 points. You get Mozgov to recreate what he did last game. And hopefully, because my rooting interest in this series is whichever team loses the game before, I root for the next game. That's how I go.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, so I'm with you. That's who I root for, because I just want as many games as possible until we don't have basketball anymore.
Yeah, it's asking a lot. And Matthew Dellavedova really had no business keeping up with any of the players in game one.
I thought that was an interesting development.
I was with a guy named Martin Rickman, who used to write for Sports Illustrated now with Up Rocks and Dime, and he was, you know, talking about how much he has disliked Deli all season, because Deli is such a gambler on the defensive end. He usually gets behind a guy, and just by luck, Tristan or somebody else has rescued him. But Deli doesn't really have the foot speed or the kind of awareness defensively to keep in front and keep an eye on these things happening all around him, which is what's going on with Steph and Clay having the ball. And him against either one of those two is just a nightmare, because that's not really his strength. His strength is playing alongside LeBron a little bit, going back and forth, hitting a couple lucky threes, and being a gambler on the defensive end. And kind of, you know, Derrick Rose, he destroyed him so many times going to the post because Deli was not physical enough and not good enough, you know, kind of one-on-one, just a normal situation to handle that sort of guy that's great offensively. And Jeff Teague did it. There were so many times when Dele got beat defensively that I think the hype just kind of got a little too overblown for it.
Yeah, that Dele, he's a 12 to 15 minute guy who should be playing against second units.
Yeah.
I don't really see much more there. There was a time earlier in the year, maybe a little bit last year, I was like, oh, maybe this guy can develop into something, not high level or anything, but into a quality role player, and he's kind of done that, but yeah, I don't think you want him. Situationally, he's someone you probably want to match up in second units.
And him playing 30 minutes with a lot of those, majority of those being against Steph or Clay, gives me the heebie-jeebies. So yeah, that's the thing that makes you a little more nervous, even with all the other ifs going into game two.
Do you do Barnes or Iggy?
You have to for at least a few minutes, but the thought might be that you play Dele as few minutes as you can. But then at that point, it means LeBron's handling the ball way too much. You need Dele in there because at least he knows the good things that happen when you move the basketball around. Sometimes, which would happen a lot, LeBron just gets stuck in wanting to do the thing he's set to do, and the ball doesn't get moved around. So that's been the positive when Dele's been on the court. And so I think we'll see 20 to 25 minutes of him. But the idea would be, you know, in crunch time perhaps or whatever, you get a lot of JR and Shump minutes.
I was about to say, what about, I mean, at this, we probably have to see LeBron, JR, Shump, Mozgov, and Thompson, right?
And there will be more James Jones. There has to be. And he'll be up against an Iguodala on the other end, and he'll be there to hopefully space the floor. You have to be creative.
He can definitely stand there.
Yeah. You know, the Cavs weren't creative in terms of their offense by any means, and they somehow managed to, you know, make it a close game for four quarters.
I've said this all along. It's very Heat year one-ish. And you hope next year they take that step forward, just like the Heat did. And the offense gets a little bit more creative. And I don't think it's... I mean, Blatt certainly, from everything you read about his reputation, this isn't the type of offense he wants to run. So
right.
If he can get the guys to buy in, the key is it's part of coaching is not just schemes. It's being able to communicate and get the guys to buy into what you want to do. That's almost as important.
It happened with Love. You know, it was happening the second half of the season.
So you thought it was already starting to get a little bit better.
Totally. Compared to the first half of the season, or, you know, look at November. November was brutal.
And then, go ahead, Andy.
No, that's actually what I've been kind of saying all postseason. I absolutely agree with that, with what Brian pretty much said, is coaching is more than that. It was more of, I think they had to get LeBron bought in, and I think everybody's really talked this out at this point, is how LeBron wants to run his offense, but that's not going to work. And I think it might have worked if guys were healthy, because they can certainly run the isolation offense to perfection, really, if they have enough spacing. But the entire defensive game kind of switches around when you have Kevin Love in as well. But pretty much is what David Blatt has, I wouldn't say failed to do, because it's year one, and also he has to deal with LeBron James, who is impossible to deal with. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's certainly a thing that's real. That you can't really do anything to the guy because he's that good. He can do whatever he wants. And I think Steve Kerr probably would have had the same problem if he was coaching that Cavs team. But he hasn't, essentially, because he's coaching guys that has bought in. And that's really, it's really much easier when you have a team like the Warriors that's ready to buy in. I think Steph was, he's the guy, he's kind of the guy that's not going to say anything bad about you, but he certainly was not happy at all when Mark Jackson was fired. And same with Iguodala. And Iguodala really was not happy when he was benched, no matter what anyone says. He was not happy about being benched. But then you have Barnes and Bogut, who were ecstatic that Mark Jackson was fired. They did not like him at all. And Draymond really loved Mark Jackson. Clay really doesn't give a, you know, doesn't care about anything. But really, having those guys bought in into that offense, and now to a point where Steph, you know, really doesn't care for Mark Jackson, is a huge shift. and really is what shocked me the most about Steve Kerr. It's not that his offense was great or his defense was also great. It's that he could get guys to buy into what he wants, and sometimes that's something you really expect to happen, but it's harder, much harder said than done. And it's pretty interesting to see this Warriors team. And I'm sure there's some sort of, I think some people were talking about a kind of a this Warriors team being, what was the thing, that they came from households that had NBA players in them already or were stable, and that helped to help them to be more trustful. Now, I'm not sure how much that comes into effect. Certainly that's not a topic for me to get into, as someone that doesn't want to be a therapist at this point. But that's certainly, you know, something that's interesting, especially from a Warrior standpoint and how they've gotten so good.
You know, and I think we do discredit David Blatt unfairly a little bit. Like, for the Cavs to be here where they are and to play as good a defense as they have, you know, some credit has to go back to Blatt. We see the isolation, and it's a very common thing to blame the coach for uncreative offensive play. But there's also the positivity on the defensive end. Absolutely. And the adjustments that's had to have been made with all the crazy injuries that have occurred all year, and for the team to have been as successful as they've been. So I think the language has changed a little bit among the Cavs players since November, December, when things were ugly and they weren't winning, to now, where I think there's been a lot of trust and bonding and really buying into Blatt overall. It's just been, they've been dealt a very tough hand.
All right, let's wrap this up. You guys have each plug whatever you need to. Jacob, you can go first. We can at least give you that.
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, it's been a tough, 20 hours or so, man. You know, it's been a really, really impressive season from the Cavs. They're a really good team with Kevin Love, with Kyrie Irving, with Anderson Varejao. And, you know, you hate to look forward to next year, as we always say, but, you know, that's what this team is. You saw how good they could be offensively from January to April. And you saw bits and pieces of how, you know, versatile and good they could be defensively in the last 2 months. And that's the thing that really gets you excited about this team when they're fully healthy. You know, I hope that, you know, for Cleveland's sake, they can win a game. I hope that they can give a really good showing and, you know, show off some of that defensive might that we've kind of seen somehow and makes this competitive. It's asking a lot. But I think overall, you know, there's some reason to think that, you know, maybe this isn't just going to be a sweep just so handily. I think there'll be a lot of fight in them, and I'll be, you know, anxious to see, you know, what their energy and motivation is like after seeing, you know, everything just fall apart in the last 2 minutes of overtime.
Final thoughts, Andy?
Yeah, actually, that's the more I think about this, the more I think Cleveland really could have a season like the Warriors of this season, mainly because there's a lot of guys on their team that are, you know, quote unquote injury prone, and you look at Kyrie Irving, who at this point is suffering so many injuries, and they're not the same to the same body part as Steph, but really, he could have a season where, like Steph, he just goes through, you know, rehab and just kind of gets his body right and really stays healthy for a couple seasons. And along with that, if they can as well have just one season. I mean, the Warriors have had one season where guys are healthy, and it's this season. And if the Cavs can kind of get that, Varejao, Kevin Love, get everybody healthy. And, of course, that works with that they're in the Eastern Conference, and the Eastern Conference is trash.
Hey, take it easy.
It's not easy to make 5 straight finals.
Yeah.
Right, but, I mean, it is really bad, though. Really bad. I mean, I won't back down on that one.
No.
It's really bad. But they can really go, maybe they'll win 60-something games just because of that, and they can run a movement offense that Blatt wants to run. And I could easily see them, you know, kind of getting guys healthy. You know, LeBron doesn't have to play so many minutes. Same with Love, same with Varejao, same with Kyrie. Get those guys healthy for one season, run an offense where it can get everyone involved. And I think they really could have a season that could mirror the one that the Warriors have. And of course, at the head of the snake there, they have LeBron James, which the Warriors don't have. So I can certainly see them just being, you know, just way better than anything the Eastern Conference has to give. And that's as bright as a future can get, right? And of course, this is all, you know, contingent on what they do with Tristan and Kevin Love. But, you know, I'm assuming here that everyone comes back. That would be it. That'd be a hell of a team.
Yeah.
Yep. They should be very good going forward. All right, guys. Thank you very much, Andy Liu, Jacob Rosen. Good stuff, as always. Much appreciated. That wraps up this edition of the Podium Game Podcast.